So you live in Corinth in the middle of the first century, and it's your birthday. And so you're going out for a meal with friends and family, and the venue is the first century Corinthian equivalent of Pizza Hut or Miller and Carter or something like that. And you get there, and many things about the place are just like Pizza Hut or Miller and Carter. There are lots of tables at which some people are already dining. There's the smell of food, there's the sound of chat and laughter. And there are waiters and waitresses busily flitting to and fro. But other things about the place are quite different from a modern British restaurant. For one thing, the waiters and waitresses aren't the only ones who are going round the tables. There are also men wearing impressive flowing robes. It's religious garb, because these men are in fact priests. And then for another thing, in the middle of the room, where you might have expected there to be a salad bar or something, there is instead a large statue of a god looking down imposingly at the diners. Anyway, after waiting for a couple of minutes, you're shown to a table and you all sit down, and soon afterwards you order your food, and a little while after that, your meals are brought to you, at which point one of these priests who are milling around comes over to your table, and because it's your birthday, he asks you to do the honours. And being a first century Corinthian, you know exactly what he means. The priest puts some of the meat that you're about to eat onto an ornate little saucer and gives that to you. You then walk solemnly over to the statue of the god in the middle of the room, and you place that plate that's in your hands on a marble table there in front of the statue. And while everyone in your group then bows their heads, you pray, asking the god to accept this meat that you're offering to him, and asking him to be present with you throughout this meal. Having finished the prayer, you then return to your table. The priest announces that the sacrifice has indeed been accepted by the god, and you all then begin to eat. So why all this rigmarole? Why does your dining experience involve all those elements? Well, because the venue where you're having this birthday meal is in fact the temple of a Greek god. But didn't I say a moment ago that the venue is the first century equivalent of Pizza Hut or Miller and Carter? Yes, I did say that. Because the temples of the gods in a city like Corinth were the equivalent of Pizza Hut or Miller and Carter. The temples weren't austere places that you went to only on special holy days for formal services. The temples were places where you went with your mates for a celebratory meal. They were restaurants, essentially. But they were restaurants where the meal always had this sacrificial dimension, this dimension of worship. How then should a Christian in Corinth relate to these temple meals? Well, of course, a Christian shouldn't touch them with a barge pole. A false god is being worshipped at these meals. But I'm sure you can appreciate that for a Christian, a Corinthian Christian, to pursue that route, for a Corinthian Christian to say, no, I'm not darkening the doors of one of these temples, that was a massive thing. I mean, if it had just been a case of a formal service taking place in the temple every week, it would have been fairly easy to refrain from that. But when the temple was this restaurant-like place that I've just described to you, refraining from that meant refraining from friends' birthdays and family gatherings and things like that. It was a massive thing to say, no, I'm not going near one of those temples. And so some Corinthian Christians weren't refraining. They were still going along sometimes to the temples. They were still participating in these kinds of meals I've described, where yes, it was primarily a social occasion, like when you go out for a birthday meal in Newcastle, but was also an act of worship. And Paul then has to address this matter, and that's what he's doing in 1 Corinthians 8 to 10. He begins this section of the letter there in verse 1 of chapter 8, now concerning food offered to idols. And this is what he's talking about, what I've just described to you. We need to be clear on that. He's not talking about food that might, at some point before it was ever purchased by you, have been offered to an idol. He will touch on that issue right at the very end of the section. Indeed, I've given our series over these Sunday evenings the title, which comes from later on in this section, Whether You Eat or Drink. Because that is a situation where Paul will say a Christian can eat when the meat has just been bought from the marketplace and you don't know what might have happened to it before you bought it. And we'll get to that then, God willing, in a few weeks' time. But in most of this section, he's not talking about that. He's talking specifically about participating in a meal actually at a temple. That's why he refers in verse 10 here of chapter 8 to eating in an idol's temple. He's referring to participating in a meal actually at the temple, during the course of which the food is offered to the idol associated with that temple. And that's a situation then in which Paul is saying the Christian mustn't eat. The Christian mustn't be there at all, in fact. The Christian mustn't be part of this pagan worship rite dressed up as though it's just a harmless social occasion. Now, you may or may not be familiar with these three chapters then, and if you are a little bit at least familiar with them, you may be aware, it may have struck you as you've read them, that there's something strange about them. There's a strange unevenness in Paul's approach here, because in chapter 10 then, Paul is very devastating in the way that he treats attendance at these temple meals. I mean, he calls it idolatry there, and he tells them to flee from it. Here in chapter 8, however, he just seems to portray it as unwise and unhelpful. By the way, chapter 9 doesn't at first sight seem to have anything to do with this whole theme at all, but we'll see how that fits in when we come to it. But for now, this is the more pressing question. If Paul is going to condemn in chapter 10 attending these temple meals as idolatrous, if it's idolatrous to do this, then surely it's just bad, end of. Why bother fussing here in chapter 8 about the effects it might have on a Christian brother or sister? Why doesn't Paul just condemn this practice outright from the word go? Why isn't chapter 8 just as strong and as devastating and condemning in its tone as chapter 10 is? That's the strange unevenness to which I'm referring. Well, let me suggest three reasons for it. First of all, I think it's a literary technique. It's a literary technique. So Paul wants to build up to a crescendo in this critique of their attendance at the temple meals, because that's more effective. If he just pulls out all the stops from the word go and kind of beats them up for engaging in idolatry, then his readers are soon going to become immune to all that bombast and fireworks. He can't sustain that for three chapters. If, however, he starts softly, then hopefully his readers will come with him as he gradually ups the ante, until eventually they'll be stunned as they hear him accusing them of idolatry. So I think it's partly a literary technique that Paul begins quite softly and then comes to chapter 10 and really goes for it. But then a second reason, the Corinthian Christians who are still visiting the temple, still going along to meals there in the way I've described, they're probably the same ones who are also, for instance, parading their ability to speak in tongues. The same ones, that is, that Paul will tackle about that issue in chapters 12 to 14. That is to say, it's probably the brash, self-confident, assertive members of this Corinthian church who are doing this. But Paul is aware that there are others in the church. There are more delicate souls in the church too. And no, he certainly doesn't want the headstrong ones to go and destroy themselves by falling into idolatry, and he'll appeal to them in that regard when he gets to chapter 10. But it's something of a biblical principle, isn't it? That if there's one thing worse than a headstrong Christian destroying himself, it's a headstrong Christian destroying another more fragile Christian. Remember how Jesus speaks in Luke 17 verses 1 and 2. Temptations to sin are sure to come, but woe to the one through whom they come. It would be better for him if a millstone were hung round his neck and he were cast into the sea than that he should cause one of these little ones to sin. And so that's where Paul begins here. Ever the tender-hearted pastor, so alive to the needs of the weakest members of the church, he begins by telling the temple visitors in the congregation that they mustn't endanger their brothers and sisters in Christ. He'll come on to saying you're endangering yourselves, but he begins by saying you're endangering the weaker, more delicate souls in the church. And then a third reason, it seems that the Corinthian temple visitors, as I'm calling them, those in the congregation who are still going along to the temples, it seems that they have written to Paul defending their practice. And so Paul is not, as it were, coming at this topic with a free hand, just immediately pouring out all his thoughts on the matter. No, they have made some points to him about it. And so he kind of begins on their terms, engaging with what they've said. That's why in these verses that we read this evening, we have several phrases in quotation marks. The ESV is very good for doing this throughout 1 Corinthians. The NIV doesn't, and it's often very confusing. Who's speaking? Is this Paul saying at the beginning of chapter 7, it's not good for a man to have sexual relations with his wife? That sounds a bit odd, but Paul is quoting them. That's why the ESV puts it in quotation marks. And the ESV does the same here in chapter 8 with three or four phrases, because Paul is often quoting what they have said to him in their defense of what they are doing. So those then are three reasons for Paul's initial treatment of this matter here in chapter 8 being surprisingly calm and low-key. The bombast doesn't come until chapter 10. But just in the remainder of our time then this evening, I want to take our cue from that third point I mentioned, the fact that Paul is engaging here with the Corinthians' own defense of their temple visiting. And obviously, Paul doesn't agree with what they've written to him in their defense of it. But in these seven verses that we're looking at, he doesn't just kind of mindlessly write off what they've written to him in defense. He basically points out three things here. Number one, where they are mainly right. Number two, where they are partially wrong. And number three, where they are completely wrong. And so we're just going to quickly look at those three emphases. So first of all, then, where they are mainly right, where the Corinthians, in what they're saying, what they've written to Paul, where they are mainly right. So these Corinthians, then, they are defending their participation in these meals at the temple on this basis: they possess knowledge. You see Paul quoting them there at the beginning of verse 1. We know, we know that all of us possess knowledge, and the bit in the quotation marks is presumably what they are saying to him. So that this is the basis on which they are defending what they're doing. We possess knowledge, they're saying. We possess knowledge. Knowledge of what? Well, look at the two quotations then in verse 4. An idol has no real existence, and there is no God but one. So those are the truths that they know, and they are very clear about, and they're going on about a lot. We know those things, these Corinthians are saying. And those statements then, in verse 4, an idol has no real existence, there is no God but one, they are mainly right. Hence Paul's confirmation there in verse 6. For us there is one God, the Father, from whom are all things and for whom we exist, and one Lord Jesus Christ, through whom are all things and through whom we exist. By the way, that's a stunning verse, isn't it? Stunning because of how natural and instinctive Paul's Trinitarianism is. Paul's way of thinking of God as Trinity. I mean, on the face of things, he's contradicting himself in that verse, isn't he? He says there's only one God, the Father. And then in the very next breath, he talks about this other being who is himself a Lord and integral to the very existence of the universe. And you kind of think, well, if there's this other being around who looks jolly well like a God himself, then is it really meaningful to be talking about there only being one God? But of course, for Paul, the existence of this other being doesn't undermine his monotheism at all, because this other being is also the one God, because for Paul, the one God is more than one person. It's stunning too because of the way that he attributes distinct roles to these different divine persons. We can sometimes be very clear that the three persons are one God, but we can't really say, well, how is the Father different from the Son, apart from having a different title? But Paul here attributes different roles to them, doesn't he? They're not boring clones of one another. Of the triune God, Donald MacLeod writes, there's no action of one person which does not also involve the action of the others, and yet no action of a person which does not have his own distinct mark. The acts of the triune God are common to all three persons, but that does not mean that each acts in the same way. The triune God creates, but the Father creates as Father, the Son as Son, the Spirit as Spirit. Each works in his own proper way. And that's what Paul is bringing out here. The creation, It's from the Father and for the Father, but it's through the Son. And you see then this distinctness, and it's such a beautiful theme, isn't it? This God who is one and yet three, and yet not three identical persons, but three persons who have their own distinctives and yet exist in such perfect harmony. It's a beautiful theme, the Trinity of our God. But you might be saying, well, how can I say then that these Corinthians, when they say an idol has no real existence, there's no God but one, they are mainly right? Surely they're completely right. Why am I saying they are mainly right? Well, look at what Paul says in verse 5. He says, there may be so-called gods in heaven or on earth, as indeed there are many gods and many lords. So Paul is saying that, yes, these gods of the temples in Corinth, they don't exist in the sense that when you take a plate of meat and put it in front of it and pray to it, it hears your prayer. Of course, it doesn't hear your prayer. It has no consciousness, no vitality, no life. In that sense, it doesn't exist, but it does exist. It's there. That statue is there, and that temple is there, and that religion is there. It exists in that sense, and that will be important for Paul, as we shall see in a moment. And so these headstrong Corinthians who are just saying, well, it doesn't matter, we can go and sit at the table and we can take part in those meals because these gods don't exist anyway. Paul is saying, well, that's mainly right. They don't exist in an ultimate sense. They're not real gods, but they do exist. The whole setup exists. That's what Paul wants to say. So where they are mainly right. But then, secondly, where they are partially wrong. Where they are partially wrong. And they are partially wrong then in thinking that Christians know what Paul writes in verse 6, that there's only one God. Because Paul goes on to say, doesn't he, in verse 7, not all possess this knowledge. No, not all Christians know that. Not all the members of the church in Corinth, Paul is saying, know what I've just written in the previous verse, in verse 6. That great confession, there's only one God. Not all the Christians in the Corinthian church know that. Now you might be saying, well, how then can they be Christians? Surely it's fundamental to being a Christian that you do renounce belief in all other deities and believe there's only one God. How can Paul be saying not all possess this knowledge? Not all the Christians in Corinth. Well, I think probably Paul here is making a distinction between, if you like, intellectual, cognitive knowledge and emotional knowledge. He's saying there are Christians in your church in Corinth whose emotions haven't yet caught up entirely with what they know. And yes, they do know at an intellectual level that there's only one God. And they did at conversion renounce whatever gods they had worshipped in the past. And they do now say creeds every Sunday, like verse 6, that there's only one God. They know that theologically. But their emotions haven't yet caught up entirely with that. Let me illustrate it this way. I have a friend who is a Newcastle United supporter. He's a season ticket holder at St. James's Park, has been for many years. He's also a policeman. And occasionally, he has to police at St. James's Park on a match day. And he says it's a very weird experience because he's walking into the stadium and there's the smell of the pies and there's the noise of the fans singing and there's the whole atmosphere. And he just kind of instinctively feels like he's a supporter there to cheer on his team. And he has to kind of keep telling himself that, no, actually, I'm here to do a job. I'm not even allowed to look at the pitch. I'm here to keep my eye on the crowd and so on. And Paul, I think, is saying that's how it is for some of the believers in this church. That if they go into one of these temples and they sit at one of those meals and the meat is presented to the statue and the prayer is made, as I described earlier, they're going to find it very hard to sit there thinking to themselves, oh, it's all just a made-up business. Nothing really is happening here. This is just a silly statue. For years, they have believed in those gods. For years, they were worshippers of those gods. And so it's going to be very hard for them to sit at that table and separate themselves from it. When they're there and they're smelling the old smells they used to smell when they were worshippers in that place, and they're feeling the atmosphere that they used to feel when they were worshippers in that place, it's going to be very hard for them not to feel that they are genuinely offering this food to the idol, genuinely taking part in some act of worship. And yet they still will know it's wrong, because they're Christians now, and so they will be thinking, I'm worshipping this God, and yet I belong to Christ. I shouldn't be worshipping this God, and yet I'm here at my friend's birthday. I can't walk out now. And they will just carry on, and they will be thinking of themselves as worshipping another God, thinking that they're sinning, and therefore, Paul says in verse 7, their conscience is defiled. They're no longer acting with integrity. They're no longer thanking Christ and worshipping Christ in their minds because they think they're defying Christ and worshipping another God. And so that's what Paul is saying. You're wrong when you say we all possess this knowledge. There are some believers who theoretically know, but for whom, sitting in an idol's temple, it'd be very hard for them not to feel they are actually engaging in an act of worship. It reminds us, doesn't it, that people enter the Christian life with an awful lot of baggage, and we can forget that at times. Think of those astonishing words of Paul to the Ephesians in Ephesians 4, verse 28, where he says, "Let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labour doing honest work with his own hands." He's writing to a Christian church here. I mean, if I kind of stood up here and said, right, my topic tonight is you've all got to stop being thieves, you can think, well, that's a bit basic, isn't it? But that's what Paul is saying to the Ephesian Christians. Some of you have got to stop going out at night and burgling houses, because that's not consistent with your Christian profession. He's got to start there. He's got to go right back to basics, because people enter the Christian life with a lot of baggage. Hannah has a colleague, and she's just recently joined the school, and Hannah was talking to her the other day, and Hannah was talking about church, and she thought this girl seemed quite interested, but then the conversation went on, and the girl said a word which, as Christians, we wouldn't normally use, a bit coarse, and anyway, the conversation carried on, and then it turned out that this girl had just been converted about 2 weeks earlier, and was this new embryonic Christian, and so easy, I guess, to just judge her on the fact that she'd used this word. But we need to remember, don't we, that at the start point of the Christian life, people aren't sorted. Many of us have been Christian for years, we're not sorted. And certainly those who are just entering in, there's a lot of baggage. And here's Paul saying there are Christians in Corinth, and if they sit at a table in an idol temple, then it's going to be very hard for them not to think that this is real, what they're doing. And they know it's wrong, and so there's all sorts of horrible contradictions going on inside them. But there's baggage there that will mean they can't just say, oh, this is all just a silly, fabricated religion. So where they are mainly right, where they are partially wrong, but then thirdly, where they are completely wrong. Where they're completely wrong. And they're completely wrong then, these Corinthians who are visiting the temples, they're completely wrong in their attitude. In their attitude. Now, Paul will then, as I said in my introduction, he will come on in chapter 10 to condemn these guys for their participation in the temple meals. He'll come on to condemn that as in itself idolatrous, quite apart from its effects on others. But for now, as I said, he kind of is starting on their terms, and he sort of assumes, for the sake of argument, that yes, because they possess knowledge, they can sit in the temples. These kind of strong Christians in Corinth, they can sit there at the table, and they can just separate themselves, and it's all just a silly, made-up religion. And so they can do it non-idolatrously. He'll come in chapter 10 and say, actually, I don't think you can. But here he's assuming, for the sake of argument, that they can do that. They can sit at the table there in the idol temple and participate in a non-idolatrous way. But he says, even if that's the case, you're not thinking of these Christian brothers and sisters, the ones I've been talking about, who are fragile and whose emotions haven't caught up with their knowledge. You're not thinking about them. You're acting as though knowledge is the only important consideration. In fact, he implies, I think, in verse 1 when he says about knowledge puffing up, he implies that these guys are even kind of boasting about this knowledge. They're perhaps deriding these weaker Christians for whom the whole thing is so complicated. What's the matter with you? We can go into those temples and we can participate fine, and it's not an act of idolatry. We know that God is the only God. And they're kind of boasting about it. They're deriding these lesser brothers in their view for whom it's all so complicated. We know. They're acting as though knowledge is the only thing that matters, the only important consideration. And Paul then says that this attitude of theirs, it raises two questions. First of all, whether they really know. It raises the question whether they really know. Because look at what he says in verse 2. If anyone imagines that he knows something, he does not yet know as he ought to know. And I think he's saying there that if you really knew, you're saying we possess knowledge. If you really knew the gospel, if you really knew the truth, if you really knew about Christ and his church, then you would be thinking of these brothers and sisters to whom you're giving such an unhelpful cue when you go into the idol temples. You would know that they are joined to you in Christ, and that you're to put them before yourselves. You would know that you are to love them and embrace them. You would know that you are to be pastors to them and nurture them in the faith. You would know that if you really knew your stuff. You would know all of that. And by the way, it is such a horrible thing, isn't it, when you see churches, for instance, breaking up over some kind of secondary theological issue, some secondary theological disagreement, and people kind of saying, well, you know, because you don't believe this and see this the way we do, you're wrong and we're separating from you. And being so focused on some aspects of the truth and yet not all those passages that tell us to love one another and tell us that we're joined to one another. And if we were really expert theologians in this book, then those passages would shoot out of the pages and hit us in the face, and we would take those seriously. The many, many passages that talk about loving one another. Paul is saying, look, if you really know, why don't you know that? Why don't you know you're supposed to care for these weaker brothers and sisters? You're going into the idol temples thinking that it's fine for you and not even considering what it's doing to them. And then the second question it raises is whether they are really known. And I think actually there in verse 3, the first occurrence of the word God, the manuscripts are divided on that and whether it's there or not. And the verse seems to read better if you leave it out, because he's not talking about loving God, is he, here in the context? He's talking about loving your brothers. So if anyone loves, i.e. loves their brothers, he is known by God. And so here's Paul, and he's saying quite bitingly, you're going on about knowledge all the time. But if you're not loving your brothers, it raises the question, not do you know just, but are you known? Are you known by God? Because a distinguishing mark of being known by God is that you love your brothers and that you care for one another. And so That's the closing challenge for us this evening. It's a theme to which Paul will return in chapter 13, isn't it? You know, if you can have all these things, including knowledge, again, that will come up. But if you don't have love, it's completely empty. And in our Reformed circles, where we rightly put an emphasis on theology, on knowledge, on the cerebral, we must be always so careful, mustn't we, that knowledge doesn't become this kind of exclusively important consideration. Love, Paul says, love is the great defining, distinguishing thing of those who are known by God. Are we a church that, yes, is pursuing knowledge, but never, ever apart from love? Are we as committed to delving the 1 Corinthians 13s of this book, the passages that are all about how we should love one another, as we are to delving the more technical parts of this book? May we be those who love one another, who are concerned for delicate souls in our congregation. Paul is saying, look, I'll come on to what you're doing to yourselves later, but you're doing damage to weak brothers and sisters. They're just following you into the idol temples. They've seen you there. They're going themselves. And they are getting caught up in this idolatry that way. They're being destroyed that way. Their consciences are being defiled. You're not thinking about them. Think about them. Put your brothers and sisters first. May God help us to do the same. Amen.